Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, background on a fascinating exhibit coming to the UK Art Museum and a new series that gets into the minds of our dog and cat friends. First, a new film that helps us better understand the moment-by-moment struggle to shake off a raging epidemic of addiction to the opioids that have done so much damage to people in the towns and rural communities of central Appalachia. Now, this film is titled Hazard, and before this interview began, I mentioned to the film's director, Eddie Menser, that I could just imagine the people of Hazard cringing on hearing that their town was being portrayed this way. Well, after we rolled tape, he had something to say about that. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Eddie.
Thank you very much for having me. I would like to say one clarification. Hazard is a story about opioid addiction in Appalachia, central Appalachia, not necessarily eastern Kentucky at all. We used the name Hazard because that's where I first did my research, and the name Hazard is a very proper name for the movie, but it's not about Perry County Hazard. It's more about central Appalachia as a whole.
So the town where it takes place could be any town in central Appalachia.
It certainly is any town in central Appalachia. If Hazard didn't have a poignant name called Hazard, it wouldn't be about it, but it's not primarily about Perry County necessarily. Even though my best friend is from there, it's where the story originated. I did my research there, but I also did my research all over central Appalachia. I'm from West Virginia, and the opioid epidemic has hit West Virginia just as much. And my stories are about Appalachia, not about Hazard, Perry County, Eastern Kentucky.
Okay, that's a really important clarification. I'm glad you made it. So if you would, give us a little bit of a description of the story that's told in Hazard.
Like all my stories, they're told really from a first-person point of view. So Hazard is about a young couple struggling with addiction, and they want to change their lives for the better, and time's running out. They're both in their early 30s. They're not kids anymore, and things have hit the fan, so to speak. Will is at the end of his road where addiction is going to take he and his family off the map for good in prison, or it could be death, or it could just be, you know, the end of the road for him. So he's at that decision to go back into rehab or just end the game altogether, so to speak. So really it's about hopefully seeing light at the end of the tunnel in the darkest of your times.
Tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to this story.
So I'm originally from West Virginia. And I'm an Appalachian filmmaker. All of my movies are about Appalachia. And my goal with the stories that I tell in general are just to tell stories that show, even if they're dark stories such as this, or my previous movie was about a coal mine disaster, I want people on the outside looking in to see us as humans and not just a stereotypical story that is in Time Magazine or USA Today. So the goal with it is to, like, even if someone's struggling in Los Angeles, California, or New York City with addiction, they can look, watch a story like this, see somebody like Will, and know that they're very much the same type of person and not a stereotype.
So how did you cast the film? I know that, of course, the leading roles are by professional actors. Seems like there might be a lot of extras there from the area. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was amazing. So we were fortunate, like as far as the locals, we filmed this in Harlan County, which is right next to Perry County Hazard. And we filmed it there because I'm trying to make probably one or two movies down the road based off that song, Never Leave Harlan Alive. So I was like, if I'm going to try to go make the movie Never Leave Harlan Alive, let's just get our boots in the Harlan now. And I met a producer, Gil Holland. His father was from Harlan. Mm-hmm. He owns the Harlan Brew Company, and he sent me to Harlan. And I was like, this is perfect. So we were fortunate enough to work with Lydia's Place, which is ARC. It's a recovery network. And Alex Rowe, our lead, got to come in and work with Lydia's Place. And we got to meet, you know, 24 people who were in recovery. And they took Alex. They let him sit in NA meetings. They took him out. They worked with him. And they were the extras in the movie. So a lot of the people who are in recovery, who you see in the movie, like those are real people in recovery who helped us behind the camera and in front of the camera. So it was important to let them sort of take a piece of this, their past that they're trying to get past of their past, and do something positive. And that was helping us make this film. So, yeah.
Alex Rowe is actually a British actor. And as I'm sure you know, people in our region are pretty sensitive about being portrayed by outsiders. We have clips, first from an interview with Alex about his role in the film Forever My Girl, a previous film that he was in, and how he adopted a Southern American accent for that. And that's followed by a clip of Alex in this role of Will from Hazard. Let's listen to them back to back.
We had a couple of sessions with a dialect coach who helped us pick out certain sounds, but yeah, it was just kind of maybe 2 one-hour sessions. And then luckily our director's from Louisiana too, so if there was anything that needed to be tweaked a little bit, she could give us advice. But we grow up with so much American TV back home and American movies, so we've heard all of these accents a lot of times, whereas you guys only really hear British accents when awkward Brits like me come and talk on the telly.
Look, I want to know what's going to happen to Sarah. I gave you the drugs, okay? Just arrest me, man. John, there's got to be something you can do.
I've seen the film, and I think that Will is incredibly plausible in that role. But did Alex have to do further study to get closer to the pretty distinctive Appalachian Kentucky accent?
So that clip you played from Forever My Girl, I've never heard, but we did the polar opposite. Alex came to Harlan County a month before filming started, and he literally, I would see him once or twice, 3 times a week, and he hung out with people from the region and hung out with people who were in recovery and learned their accent to the best of his ability. But that gentleman came from California and spent a month in Harlan County just learning the dialect and learning about addiction, just to portray them with as much honesty as possible.
I think we're going to see more of Alex Rowe, aren't we? he's pretty great.
He's an amazing actor, and it's not like this was a big budget Hollywood movie where he had to do that. Like, he did that out of his own heart and his own truthfulness to tell the story.
That's a person who believes in their craft. So who wrote the screenplay?
I did.
You did. Okay. You did that and you're directing.
Yes, sir. And I produced it and probably washed people's clothes or something
done. And the score is really interesting too. Who did that?
Thank you. His name is Mauricio Yazzigi. We've made 3 movies together now. He's based in Los Angeles. He's actually from Chile. But he understands the type of he understands my movies, so he you know, has the music. But all of the actual music that is in the movie is all Appalachian musicians from the region.
Okay, now the film opens in New York on January 31st and in Los Angeles February 7th. And some in our listening area may cringe when they hear that. There's a lot of concern among Appalachians, as you know, about how they're portrayed to the rest of the world. We all know about those stereotypes. How do you address those concerns?
You know, my entire, like, my filmmaking career is addressing those stereotypes. So I am that stereotype. I am that West Virginia person that had moved to Los Angeles for 15 years of his life and was stereotyped. And the movies that I make are about ending those stereotypes. So I fully understand that people from Hazard could be weary of the project, and that's why we're going there on the 9th to do a community screening to put them at ease. But I am fully aware of how people's opinions can be about this story.
To change the subject a little bit, Kentucky is becoming known for having some pretty incredible film incentives, production incentives. Were you able to take advantage of those?
We absolutely did, and that's why I went to Kentucky for this one. I was preparing this movie to film in the state of Georgia because they have a tax credit, and at the time, Kentucky did not have a tax credit. And that's when our executive producer, Gil Holland, contacted me and said, Kentucky's tax credit is back. There's no way you're making this movie outside of Kentucky, and he sent me to Harlan County.
Well, who on the ground in Harlan County ought to be credited for helping make this happen? Did you have some folks there that helped you out?
Yes, sir, I did. So just so you know, when you talk about being weary of outsiders, we filmed this in July of 2022. And I believe I started going there in December of 21 just to meet the people and for them to accept me. So it took me 6-7 months to be able to even film there. But the magistrate, Paul Browning, he's our saving grace in the Tri-City area of Harlan County. If it wasn't for Paul, he's the magistrate there in the Harlan Economic Development. That's it. They met me. They knew that I wasn't doing anything in vain. And once I broke through that first layer of trepidation, they opened up their hearts.
Well, Eddie, what sort of impact or what kind of outcome are you hoping for here?
The outcome that I desire is for people on the outside looking in to see that addiction is addiction and we're just not people from Appalachia who you can stereotype. That what happened to Appalachia happened to everybody, you know, all over, and that we're all the same people in this world. And there's so much separation in our world today as it is. And I'm just hoping to bridge that gap slightly, just to be like we're all one human, we're all one soul.
That's Eddie Menser, director of the new film Hazard, about the struggle in a central Appalachian town to break free from opioid addiction. It's premiering in theaters across the region, and Menser will be on hand to take questions after a screening of the film at the Movie Tavern at Brannan Crossing on January 17th. Thanks so much, and good luck with this, Eddie.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
When you look at a color-coded map in a report from the National Institutes of Health on opioid use disorder in Kentucky, the highest rates are concentrated in our listening area of eastern Kentucky. Shortly after my earlier conversation with film director Eddie Menser, I got a heads up from the folks at the Daily Yonder about a podcast they produced that takes us into a rural Appalachian community, this one in Virginia, struggling with a high rate of addiction among its people, how they got this way, and a sensitive, patient approach to helping people struggling with addiction find their way out of it. You'll be able to listen to the full podcast during our hour on Sunday evening at 6 p.m., and there'll be a link to listen anytime on our website at esweku.org. But joining us now is Sarah June Jacebo, the host of On the Rebound, Stories from Recovery Court. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me on the program.
Oh, you bet. And as you do in the beginning of your podcast, give us some context concerning where you grew up and then what you found in your new hometown of Galax in Western Virginia.
So I'm from northern Minnesota and farm country in Iowa. And as an adult, I've had to relocate a few times with my husband's work in stone manufacturing. And a few years ago, we moved to Galax in Southwest Virginia. And when we got here, I was surprised to come across folks who were overdosing in public. And back in the Midwest, just for context, drug use can be a little more hidden in rural areas because we have a lighter population density. So folks might be cooking meth 5 miles away from their nearest neighbor. But in Southwest Virginia, rural areas have a greater population, and so it's easier to come across people who are using. You might have a few households in a single quarter mile section, and so the troubles happening at your neighbor's place is more visible. And also, because Appalachia was one of the first places the Sackler family targeted heavily with their prescription opioids. So what we're seeing here in the Blue Ridge Mountains is second and third generation addiction issues and drug distribution economies with origins from 30 years ago. We also have two big drug rehab facilities now in our area that treat mostly people from Virginia's cities like Richmond and Virginia Beach. So we have issues with residents at these facilities who get discharged with nothing but the clothes they arrived in. And these residents wander around Galax or Hillsville, and sometimes they find a way to get high until they can catch a ride back home.
In small town places, everybody tends to know everybody and what everybody's up to. So you can be much more vulnerable in those kinds of circumstances. Let's listen to Jessica.
Just started following the outcast crowd, the ones that were making bad decisions, and older people that were making bad decisions because they didn't pass judgment and they let you do whatever you wanted to do. I continued drinking, and then I started smoking pot when I was about 12. That older crowd, they're just getting their license, or they're just they're hanging out on the corner at the park, you know, behind the scenes in the shadows. And I'm like, oh, what are they doing, you know? And they're kind of dressed like I am, and they come from the poor families. And you hear about other people talk about them, so you're like, okay, well, maybe that's for me. And like I said, they don't pass judgment, and they just take you right on into their flock, and you just become a part of something.
So the older people Jessica looked up to, still teens and young adults themselves, were doing drugs. But what about older adults, parents, teachers, law enforcement? Where are they in all this?
This is interesting because I think there's been a recent shift in some of our understanding of addiction and distribution. The people I spoke with were preteens and teenagers in the 1990s. And back then, young people getting involved with drugs were treated like troublemakers. But in the last few years, basically 30 years after the outset of the Sackler-OxyContin distribution push, I think attitudes are changing finally because we understand more that addiction is a disease and that especially when your drug use begins in childhood, your chances for sobriety in adulthood are very tough. And with this in mind, community leadership, like teachers and law enforcement, they still have a long way to go, but there has been a shift. The parents of these kids in the 1990s, on the other hand, are, for the most part, really hardworking people. They're working long hours in area factories or in semi-professional roles in places like our public schools. These parents are working long hours in order to keep the roof over their head and to provide for their kids. But they don't have a lot of time outside of work to be available for them or help their kids navigate peer pressure or other predatory adults in the community. So I have a hard time holding the parents responsible for their kids' issues with addiction today because they're just doing what society wants them to do, which is basically to work really hard.
Well, I guess basically, too, after you pulled a day like that, you're exhausted. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
So when reporting about these high rates of addiction in small towns and rural places, media has tended to amplify the voices of the authorities. You wanted to get the perspectives of the people who are actually going through addiction and recovery. Why was that important to you?
So I really think that we need to empower people who live with addiction or who have survived systems of incarceration and drug culture. We need their voices at the decision-making tables concerning policing, policy, and rehabilitation treatment because they've lived through these experiences and they know best the population who continues to struggle in addiction or in these systems. Usually the people in power who represent law enforcement or government or medical therapies are the people who've had the privilege of higher education and access to advancement. So we need to balance out the voices at the decision-making tables with people who have an inside understanding of the issues they faced.
Well, you heard from people like Eric, and he was talking about how law enforcement and the court system can be a revolving door of incarceration instead of access to good rehabilitation care and how that derails lives. Let's listen to Eric.
It's just like a revolving door, especially when you're in addiction because, you know, you go into the system and you never get no help for the underlying addiction. and you go into the system and you're an addict. There's drugs in there too. So you use drugs in there, and then you get thrust right back out into the same situation you was in.
So, Sarah June, what did you learn about how a school system or local law enforcement can actually turn against these young people in ways that just perpetuate addiction?
Yes. So in my conversations with folks here in the Galax area, you hear about a history of law enforcement, juvenile detention, and educators who are basically acting like a microcosm extension of what the Sackler family is doing. They're behaving like predators against kids who are already facing lots of challenges, anything from classism or to racism. So our leadership in communities tend to punish the kids here or treat them like deviants. And I just want to give some context. I'm talking about behaviors of, from our leadership from like 30 years ago, 25 years ago. Today, like I said earlier, some of our attitudes may have shifted a little bit in our school districts and our policing. But back then, the population that I've interviewed for this program are talking about something that had been pretty normal and routine from a while back. So basically, the people that I've interviewed since childhood, most of this group weren't offered any help by school teachers or law enforcement back then. And instead, they were punished and ostracized. And kids really have sensitive nervous systems, and they're constantly observing the adults in their lives and picking up on micro expressions. It's how they learn to survive, and it's how kids learn who the world thinks they should be. And so if a 12-year-old is already finding their way to drugs or alcohol, or all the teachers are white and displaying prejudice, or if their families can't afford for the kid to join music or sports activities, that kid is learning that they're not accepted by the dominant culture of the school and community. So they're vulnerable to falling into a cycle of misbehaving and self-medication through huffing or drugs and alcohol.
Your podcast series is not focused just on addiction, but also on a solution. And you were just talking about how we've kind of shifted toward this over the recent years, toward what is called recovery court there in Virginia. We call them specialty courts here in Kentucky, and how this helped people like Casey.
Recovery court is a great program. I wasn't used to having people that could be there for me to help me. You know, if you need them, they're there for you.
Casey's story really points out what addiction as a child can take away from you, and how sobriety, on the other hand, is helping her learn who she is for the first time.
You know, when I very first got sober, I will never forget thinking, I don't belong. Like, I didn't feel like I fit in, because it had been so many years. You know, if you think of 15 until you're 40, I didn't know what straight was. I make a joke to my friends all the time. I don't even know how I like my eggs, because, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know who I am. I didn't know anything about myself. But I'm learning daily, or I'm learning throughout what it's like or who I am.
So it sounds as though in towns with high addiction rates, a lot of the important self-discovery that normally goes on when you're in your teens just isn't happening. What do you think that delayed self-awareness looks like on a community level?
Well, you're looking at teenagers that aren't going out and getting jobs or going on to higher education if they're graduating from school. And so we're losing a segment of population who are joining the workforce and becoming taxpayers, really. But what is happening for people like Casey in kind of a delayed response is that on a community level, we're seeing them return as adults, and they're able to parent their own kids now. Some of them are returning to college, picking up where they left off. They're getting higher paying jobs, and they're getting into stable housing. So even though it's a little bit of a delayed maturity in our society, we're learning that people do want to contribute when they reach sobriety.
So how does this work, this recovery court? What is recovery court doing differently than other drug courts around the country?
So a regular drug court requires people with drug offenses to pay their fines, maybe attend a weekly NA meeting, attend check-ins with law enforcement or social workers. But Judges Harrell and Geisler here in Grayson and Carroll counties renamed their drug court to Recovery Court, which actually prompted Virginia's state representatives to rename the state's entire drug court systems to Recovery Court. And in our district here, Judges Harrell and Geisler worked with a local athletic trainer to develop a weekly fitness class where they work alongside the people going through Recovery Court. So the fitness class was a starting place where law enforcement, judicial, and people facing drug charges come together in a new space where they exercise together and get to know each other as human beings. It's about building a bridge for community. So people who may have never felt like they belonged in the dominant culture of their community are now finding a way to make new connections.
Well, you heard from many who've gone through this process, the recovery court. And here's one of them, Mary Ann, talking about the positive support she gets from recovery court and recovery fitness and the judges and law enforcement team she works out with.
They see you differently. And not only do you get to learn about them, but they learn about me as well on a completely different level. You know, it's just like the workout class on Thursday nights that we have. We work out with the Commonwealth attorney. We work out with the two judges. You know, when you walk in a courtroom, they only see you with those charges that you have. They don't know who you are. You know, this workout program that we have with them, we sit down, we talk, we pray. They get to know you and we get to know them on a completely different level. We become friends, you know what I mean? And that means so much. And if you do good or even if you do bad, they still lift you up.
Yeah.
You know, because they want to see you do good and succeed in this life.
Yeah.
So Sarah June, what do you hope people who listen to On the Rebound understand about how addiction's playing out in rural and small town America?
I hope this project helps listeners fight their own stereotypes about who they think rural and small town people are. I hope they learn that we can respond differently to people who live with addiction. Taxpayers funding incarceration for drug charges only exacerbates the issue. Let's divert those dollars to good rehabilitation care instead. I also hope that our lawmakers seek out many voices from the rural localities they represent when considering funding for substance use disorder and about policing drug possession and distribution. We need to help families here in drug culture find their way to good rehabilitation services and also help families to be good mentors and be available for their kids.
All right, you can listen to the full podcast, On the Rebound, Stories from Recovery Court, during Eastern Standards Hour on Sunday evening at 6 p.m. here on WEKU. Sarah June Jacebo, thank you so much for this preview.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Coming up after the break, the art and music of Jay Bolotin.
Jay was a kind of one-of-a-kind person.
And a new Q&A series about our dogs and cats. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. We have for you the latest from our partnership with UndermaineArts.org, interviews about the arts in our region, hosted by the appropriately named Art Sheckett. Stuart Herodner is Art's guest this week. Stuart is the director of the University of Kentucky's Museum of Art, where they're getting ready for their next big exhibition.
Welcome, Stuart, to WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you. The UK Art Museum has an exhibition opening on January 17th of 2025 titled Jay Bolotin, A Jackleg Testament, featuring the work of Kentucky-born artist Jay Bolotin. This exhibition had been long in the planning. Full disclosure, I provided some of the funding for this exhibition.
And we thank you.
Happy to do it. But sadly, the circumstances of the exhibition changed this year, with the death of the artist in May, in the midst of working on his latest projects for this exhibition. Before we get into the particulars about the show, Stuart, tell our listeners about Jay Bolotin, the exhibiting artist.
I met Jay soon after I came to my position as director of the Art Museum. Might be interesting to know that Jay had been in dialogue with our former curator, Janie Welker. He would be, whenever he had a new project or a new portfolio of prints, he tended to sort of hit the road and try to show what he was up to various curators, people that he knew, other artists, potential patrons and collectors. And he really impressed the hell out of me. He had works in the collection at the Art Museum, but we had never really done a big project with him. And it was very funny when I met him. Janie had said, well, you know, he's coming in on this day. He wants to bring this new portfolio, basically the story of this character that he had invented, Only Enoch. It was a series of woodcuts and intaglio etchings. And I said, well, that's great. I have about a half an hour to meet with him. That would be wonderful. And, you know, 3 hours later, we were still going at it. And I've met some pretty amazing artists in my life and have worked with many. Jay was a kind of one-of-a-kind person.
What was Jay Bolotin like as a person?
So Jay was very self-possessed, in a way, kind of quiet. You were one of those people that when you're in his company, you were forced to kind of lean in and pay attention. He spoke quietly but strongly. I mean, a brilliant guy. And, you know, I should say that one of the things that impressed me upon meeting him was the fact that he knew how to do so many things masterfully. I mean, he grew up in Lexington. He was primarily a self-taught artist, although he studied briefly at the Rhode Island School of Design.
He grew up on a farm in rural, outside of Lexington, right?
Yeah.
In a Jewish family.
In a Jewish family, in a you know, in a kind of agrarian world, and he was interested in, even as a young person, in stories, in songs, in kind of narrative traditions. Once he started reading, he was a voracious reader, and he was interested in oral histories and various traditions and things that get passed down from people, and he became one of those kinds of people. Like many, you know, let's use the word outsider artists or self-taught, untrained artists in terms of the academy, he went where his passions took him. And so he became quite skilled as a musician, as a singer, as a songwriter. And I think from the very early age, he was embedded in the idea that his work and his purpose was to create and tell stories. And in a way, he chose media, whether it was writing and singing, whether it was drawing and sculpting, then later becoming a masterful printmaker. All of that was at the service of using words, using language, and using images.
And he had some success, actually, early on as a singer-songwriter in Nashville, didn't he?
Yeah, he moved there in the 70s and became, part of a circle of like-minded singer-songwriters, Merle Haggard, Kris Kristofferson, Rita Coolidge, people that embraced him as a peer, people that really liked what he was doing. His works were, you know, I don't know that they were commercial in a way that Jay's music and his stories were just quirky and didn't exactly fit into, you know, kind of mainstream storytelling.
Although Dan Fogelberg had a hit song with one of his songs.
He did. And the thing about Jay, which was really amazing, is that the through line between his singing and songwriting and the things that become his narrative impulses in art making share so many of the same qualities. They're funny. They're tender. They're surreal. They're heartbreaking on some level. They're very much about identity and being, families, love, fatherhood, childhood. Those were the things that kind of drove him. And so no matter what form his work was taking, you could tell it, this is a Jay Bolotin thing.
Linda lost a lover in the early part of autumn, and she moved out to the country, hoping all would be forgotten. The last time that I saw her, she was making sure the winter wouldn't come through that old door frame, where the door is several inches from the ground, the cold, hard ground. And it's hard to go down easy, and it's hard to keep from crying, and it's
printmaker, sculptor, filmmaker, singer-songwriter, composer. I think for his first film, he wrote an opera piece. And it seems that Jay's creativity was boundless. What are some of the things that really stand out to you about his creative processes across all of those modalities?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, I think, a question around what defines somebody's drive and ambition. You know, visiting Jay's studio in Cincinnati, you know, several times was not only like a once-in-a-lifetime kind of treat, but you were very aware of the work ethic behind this person. So this was a guy who went into the studio, worked 15, 17-hour days, was really the only person who could create the materials that connected to the ideas that were in his head. He also, I should say, I think was a kind of natural-born collaborator. As much of the studio work as was isolating and kind of a one-man band, he worked with colleagues who were, you know, helping him build sets and occasionally helping with, you know, working on plates for printmaking. Certainly all of his work in music and in theater, you mentioned this opera, you know, building sets and working with musicians and lighting people. And Jay performed all over the world and was kind of a known person. He had time in New York. He had time in Nashville. He went to more dominant art centers, but his daily life was really in the studio in Cincinnati. And one of the things that should also be said, because I think it's important to know how people sustain a life, was that he really early on had a deep connection to the Carl Solway Gallery. And now that Carl has passed on, Michael Solway, I mean, he worked for decades with Carl and had exhibits there. Michael was just telling me the other day the story about Carl visiting Jay in his then studio and seeing these amazing drawings, but also encouraging Jay to look into printmaking, because it was a way of making multiple images. It was a way of potentially creating things that might be easily more sellable, more shareable. Printmaking, you know, obviously being something that has multiple, you know, parts of an edition. And, you know, when Jay starts tackling printmaking, he doesn't go modest. He goes, let me make 4 and 5 foot woodcuts, some of which we have at the museum and some of which will be on view during this exhibit. So, you know, when Jay did things, he was all in. And even if he didn't know about it exactly, how to make it, how to do it, he could teach himself how to do it, including all of the digital technologies required to become an animated filmmaker.
Yeah, when I visited with you his studio one time, it was like entering a whole other world. It was a created world that began after the door closed, and it was just Jay's world that he was creating in that studio space.
And a lot of it was, and this is sort of maybe something that should come up in discussion, to the idea about what is available to us now that Jay has passed away, is that even when Jay was alive and even when you were talking with him, there was always a sense that he's the only one who really knows what all of this, you know, narrative, this kind of epic story that he was telling with multiple characters, multiple parts, pasts, futures, that he was really the only one who knew in the end what all of it was about and what all the connections were. And I recently wrote, and I think mentioned to you, that I really feel like while we can situate Jay in dialogue with other artists, it's maybe even more apt to connect him to people like, you know, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or George Lucas and Star Wars, as well as, you know, Henry Darger and his, you know, exploits of the Vivian sisters, or an artist like Matthew Barney creating, you know, unbelievably inventive characters and stories and multi-part narratives that, you know, you have to watch 9 films to be able to understand where all of this winds up. And so Jay's work, I think, it's very available. You can get a lot out of it by looking and not worrying about whether you know where it all leads. But certainly the film that he was working on tirelessly in the last couple of years, and we had hoped would finish before the show, you know, that's the piece that's never going to get seen. And that's the sort of sadness that hovers over this, is that while we're going to celebrate Jay's creativity in a very big way and show his movement from printmaking to drawing to sculpting to set making to film, we're not going to get to see this final film.
Yeah, when Jay died, he was working on the movie The Jackleg Testament Part 2, The Book of Only Enoch. And of course, he's referencing there the Book of Enoch, which was a non-canonical part of the Apocrypha that's obscure and that most people probably know very little about. But he sort of went with it and crafted a whole other story to go with his idea. And he had his other film, Part 1, is Jack and Eve, where his riff on the Book of Genesis, really.
Right.
So what are his animated films? What are they like? What do viewers see in those animated films?
Well, the first thing that I think you see, and we'll have some clips from the first animated film, which is the one you just mentioned, Jack and Eve, which is, you know, according to Jay and others, the first full-length woodcut movie, which was, you know, Jay's impulse to take a woodcut portfolio that he had made with these characters, Eve and Jack, who is a Jack in the Box, who in a way tries to lure Eve away from Adam in the garden and offer her a different trajectory. And so, you know, he created this entire portfolio, and the portfolio was then used, flora, fauna, architecture, figures, to be cut apart and used for animation, which was, you know, in a sense, stop-action animation. So a kind of brilliant idea. He's already got the raw materials. He uses it then to make this narrative. He then got more sophisticated as he became more aware of film technology, animation histories, and what the digital would allow him. So then he starts to say, okay, not only can I draw hundreds of drawings, which will give me the component parts of bodies, clothing, situations, expressions, hand gestures, all of that. But now I'm going to create, against green screen technologies, sets, elaborate sculptures made of balsa wood and plaster and cobblestones and streets. I referenced it recently as like it feels like the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. You know, it has a kind of German expressionist feel. It's wonky, it's angular. The houses are stable, but, you know, you might not want to walk down the hallway. And so there is this very unstable, anxiety-producing quality, which I really believe, and Jay was a big fan of people like Kafka and Bruno Schulz and writers who addressed 20th century horrors and feelings of, you know, anxiety and the human being against the state and the human being against history and, you know, a kind of Jewish anxiety maybe as well. And so he creates these worlds which are anything can happen. There's a kind of gray moodiness to the way the sets and the figures move. They're on journeys of self-discovery and wonder in terms of what happens in the narrative. And I think like a Star Wars and like The Hobbit and like some of these things that we feel very comfortable talking about as multi-part epic situations, it was all in Jay's head. And his life's work was like getting it out of his head into a form that others could share. So I think what you're going to see when you come to the exhibit, and we've unpacked it in a way that I think is very followable, is you see him making prints, you see him animating those, you see him building a big, grander vision for what can be in a single frame of one of these moments in a film, which could be the set, the figures moving, smoke, fire, birds flying over. And then this is where the collaboration thing kicks in, because he decided that not only would he score most of the music and voice one or two of the characters, he would engage people like the actor Brad Dourif, one of his favorite actors, Will Oldham, the musician and performer from Cincinnati.
Bonnie Prince Billy.
You know, other theater performers and regional talents. You know, and these were people that he solicited by sharing his work with them, asking whether they would collaborate, often trading work with them for their services. And so sound and voice that are seen in this film that we will be showing sequences from are spoken by and acted out by some of these amazing people that Jay solicited. And he was fearless in that regard, which is one of the things I love the most about him. Is, you know, he'd get in a car and drive across the country to go to Los Angeles to meet with the actor Michael York, because he was convinced that Michael needed to play, you know, a puppeteer in his movie. And that didn't pan out because of Michael's health. But, like, you're this 70-year-old guy, you get in your little car with your portfolio and some moxie, and you drive to California or Woodstock to meet Brad Dourif, one of his acting heroes, and try to just convince the guy to participate.
He was a generous artist. He wanted to share his world with everybody and draw lots of people in.
And I think people, once they met Jay and saw the magical aspects of what he was doing, they felt privileged to be in this service with him. I think by the time you leave, you'll have an amazing sense of what this person's accomplishment really was.
Thanks again for coming down, Stuart, and talking with us. This sounds like a really exciting exhibition. Hope that lots of folks get there. Thanks again for coming.
My pleasure.
We love dogs and cats here at Eastern Standard. You may have noticed that Studio Dog and Very Good Girl, Ella Fitzgeraldine, is mentioned in our closing credits. If you share a space with a dog or cat, or both, you, like us, have probably been puzzled by certain things that they do. So we're going to go in search of some answers in a new series with Ellen Furlong, a dog cognition researcher at Transylvania University, and Berea College cat cognition researcher Rebecca Singer. If you have a question, email it to us at es@eku.edu, and we'll work it into the lineup. We're going to begin with a question for both Ellen and Rebecca. Ellen, one of our listeners, Jesse Pena, is asking, how does cognition differ between dogs and cats? And you're a dog person, so what can you tell us?
Yeah, I'm a dog person. I also have cats, so I do like cats. But in terms of my research, I pretty much just study dogs these days. This is a really tricky question because we know a lot about dog cognition. Dogs are just really easy participants. They're happy to come into the dog lab. They will work for treats. They're very easy to study. Cats, on the other hand, are a little bit trickier to study. They don't really want to come into the lab and do experiments. And they may or may not be super motivated by treats in the same kind of way that dogs are. They seem to be a little bit more timid when it comes to interacting with new objects. So it's a little bit hard to answer the question because methodologically, we just have a lot more research on dogs. Having said that, I think there's reason to hope that soon we will have more information about cats. People have started to do a lot of research with cats using citizen science. So instead of having the dogs come to us or the cats come to us, we go out to the cats and study them in their homes, or even better, Zoom in so the cats are not thrown off by the presence of a stranger in their homes. So more work is coming, but we don't really have a great answer about this question yet.
I imagine there's some cats out there that just insist we call their agent. But
yes, exactly.
Knowing cats as we do.
Exactly.
We just heard from Ellen Furlong on dog cognition. Now with us is Rebecca Singer. Her specialty is research into cat cognition. And we have the same question for you, Rebecca, from Jesse Pena. How does cognition differ between dogs and cats?
Thank you. This is a hard question because there's so much more research that's been done on dogs. There's only a handful of researchers looking at cats, and I'm even just beginning my own research into cats. What we know right now is that there are significant differences in the brains of dogs and cats, with dogs having bigger brains and more neurons, which would suggest that they are smarter. However, we also know that in cat brains, they have larger areas devoted to spatial cognition, so navigation and hunting and vision. And one of my favorite researchers said, asking about who's smarter is like asking, is a hammer a better tool than a screwdriver? Well, they're both specially designed for their specific environment and their specific problem. And so I think what we're going to find is that both cats and dogs are really good at what they're meant to do. And the answer is still out there. We don't really know exactly what cats can do because we're still trying to figure that out.
Ellen Furlong on what dogs think and do. Rebecca Singer on what's going on in cats' heads. They'll be with us from time to time, taking your questions about that puzzling thing your dog or cat is doing. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and NPR. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.